close out the program, I spoke with Dr. Matthew Goetz of the Mayo Clinic, and he began by presenting a patient with metastatic triple-negative breast cancer.
This is a 55-year-old female that I've been taking care of. She actually is an employee that I saw who actually presented with a mammographically detected 2.5-centimeter grade 3 triple-negative breast cancer. Now, interestingly, when I saw her after resection, we did speak to about standard AC taxane chemotherapy. She was very concerned about the potential risks related to leukemia from the anthracyclines as well as the cardiac risk. So we actually ended up giving her docetaxel and cyclophosphamide chemotherapy. She received 4 cycles of that.
You know, it's interesting. This was, 6 years ago. And I was thinking back to when TC, sort of came in and still there. Any thoughts about this issue today? We saw some data at ASCO looking at the question of anthracyclines or not from the NSABP. You think you might have approached this any differently today? Maybe would you have been, more interested in giving it her anthracycline?
Yeah, I think as the data are emerging, clearly for the triple negative breast cancer, I'm certainly inclined to be administering a standard anthracycline and taxane-based chemotherapy for these patients. And especially with these recent data from ASCO, they certainly support that. I think there's obviously a question, it has been a question for a while, can we substitute the TC chemotherapy? But I think as time is going on, especially for the triple negative breast cancer subset, it's really making sense to us that this is probably the right regimen we should be delivering.
So this lady then got her adjuvant chemotherapy. What was sort of the next step along the road?
Yeah, so she just went into a routine follow-up. She presented about 3 years later with a left axillary recurrence as well as supraclavicular region. She also had on PET scan some hypermetabolic lymph nodes as well. And her disease, given the lack of sort of life-threatening visceral involvement, we actually elected at the time to treat her with an HDAC plus aromatase inhibitor study. The premise of this particular study, of course, was that by using an HDAC inhibitor, one could upregulate the estrogen receptor. And unfortunately, she did not receive benefit, and she progressed relatively rapidly within 2 months. And then shortly thereafter, we went on to treat her with a regimen of carboplatin and paclitaxel. Again, one of the things that sort of, if you will, colored our approach to this patient was her quite resistance, if you will, to receiving anthracycline-based chemotherapy.
Could I just ask, along the way, did she have BRCA testing?
She did, and she was BRCA negative.
And just as a note on that, what are your guidelines right now in metastatic disease for doing BRCA testing as a therapeutic issue?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think especially with the data showing that the frequency of BRCA mutations are really not uncommon in triple negative breast cancer patients, we are generally obviously recommending that patients be tested. Now, the guidelines will typically say, if they're less than 60 with a diagnosis of triple negative breast cancer. But I think in general, we're beginning to see that this has implications, obviously, not just for the hereditary aspect in decision making, but also potentially therapeutically.
Also, I see that this lady got a platinum agent, carboplatin paclitaxel. How do you approach the use of platinum agents in metastatic disease and triple negative and also ER positive, HER2 negative?
Yeah, so in the triple negative breast cancer setting, my approach is, typically when I see patients, my approach oftentimes is to use sequential single agents. I think there's been a lot of data in the past that has demonstrated that obviously doublets clearly do give you a higher response rate, but without clear survival advantage. In this particular situation, we decided to treat her with a platinum agent. There was some concern here because she had had relatively rapid progression on the prior therapy, so we elected to go with the doublet chemotherapy. But in general, my approach for triple negative breast cancer is to at some point use a platinum-based therapy. And my approach oftentimes with platinums is either to use cisplatin alone or when I'm using carboplatin, either to combine it with a taxane or with gemcitabine.
So this lady then kind of has gone down a route that maybe is not that uncommon. She got TC adjuvantly, then she had relapse. She got, as you say, paclitaxel and carboplatin. Looks like she got some radiation therapy. What's your general sequencing beyond that point? And what was your next systemic therapy that you gave this lady?
Yeah, so I think that in general in this situation when I'm seeing patients, I will make sure that patients have received anthracyclines and taxanes. As I mentioned, the anthracyclines was really not a place to go for this patient. Once patients progress in that setting, I'm typically thinking, obviously, about a clinical trial. And in an off-study setting, obviously, I will attempt to use capecitabine, although some data in the past has suggested that capecitabine as a single agent in triple-negative breast cancer may not be quite as robust in terms of response rates. But certainly in patients that have more, if you will, or less aggressive disease, I would certainly consider capecitabine. When it comes to the other single agents, I'm inclined to use eribulin. I'm inclined to use gemcitabine as well. And so my sequence in this situation obviously takes into account patient variables, their preferences, perhaps toxicities from prior drugs such as neuropathy.
So what happened with this lady? What was her next treatment?
Yeah, so she actually unfortunately had a somewhat mixed response. So she had some improvement in the hilar and mediastinal lymph nodes, but she had some progression in the supraclavicular and also in the axillary region. And so she actually at that point decided that she wanted a break from all treatment. And since her disease was mainly nodal, we actually focused on those regions in the left supraclavicular as well as in her axillary region that were actually most symptomatic. And so we actually gave her a break off of chemotherapy. She wanted to receive some radiation to those areas. She received the radiation therapy. She had some response, but as one would expect, she did then eventually progress. We then went on to treat her with single agent eribulin, and she had a fantastic response to eribulin. In fact, she had, after two cycles or four cycles of therapy, she went on to actually have a complete response by PET scan. Interestingly, after we treated her, she actually did go on to develop some symptoms of neuropathy. And in retrospect, it was unclear exactly what component was this related to the eribulin. She had actually some concern about a brachial plexopathy that was worked up and was negative. But ultimately, after about six cycles of the eribulin, she actually went off therapy, and she was actually watched for a prolonged period of time and did quite well without any evidence of progression. And in fact, she had a disease-free interval of well over a year.
And then what happened?
So she did have some recurrence and progression again in the left axillary lymph node. And at that time, she actually wanted a period of time off of chemotherapy and did not want to go back on the chemotherapy. And because this was causing her some symptoms, we elected actually just to excise this lymph node. Interestingly, this particular patient did not have evidence for progression again in any visceral areas in a somewhat more indolent course, if you will.
And what's her current situation?
So at this time, she actually remains disease-free. She's continued to be followed by scans on an every 3 to 4 month basis.
Wow, I guess you would never have predicted this a couple years ago. I certainly would have. Maybe, I'm just kind of curious. Obviously, this lady responded way differently or way better to eribulin than the average patient. What's your vision about how the drug works and any concept about why, you know, a patient would have a response like this and, you know, others will have progressive disease?
Yeah, so, you know, I think in this situation, one of the things that makes me wonder when I see patients with this type of response is whether we're getting enough cell kill and whether we're actually getting some activation of the immune system in this situation that is leading to these types of robust responses. Because I think, as you pointed out, clearly we would not expect this degree of response. And so perhaps the combination here of both the radiation that she received previously, as well as the more robust response from the eribulin, is at least in part immune related. And I think this is obviously one of the things that's quite interesting in patients who have a diagnosis of metastatic disease. When we think about the concept of chemotherapy, we generally obviously think about direct cell kill. But in this situation, one has to at least wonder whether some release of antigens could potentially be activating an immune component and leading to this more favorable response that we see.
And, you know, obviously the course of this patient and the indolent nature and, you know, you take out a, you know, met and she's stable is not typical for metastatic breast cancer or metastatic triple negative breast cancer. What are your thoughts about, you know, it's very controversial, comes up in almost every cancer that we deal with, which is the question of multiplex testing, next generation sequencing for the patients. And with triple negative, you know, they run out of approved options pretty quickly. Is that something you do? If you had done it on her, any guesses what you might see that might explain what's going on here?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And I think what we know, obviously, as of right now, this is not quite yet standard of care. There's a lot of institutions that are using this, and certainly we are as well, in a more of a research setting. And by that, I mean using the sequencing to identify targets for which patients can be actually placed on potential clinical trials. I think obviously we don't have the data as of yet showing the utility of this for, if you will, FDA-approved drugs that we can take off the shelf, leading to data that supports that patients will have better outcomes. But I do believe that in a situation where we've exhausted options, that having that information at hand can potentially help guide clinicians onto clinical trials. For example, when it comes to the certain subtype of triple-negative breast cancer, the so-called luminal androgen receptor subtype, again, we don't have any FDA-approved drugs, but clearly there is emerging data in this situation that the presence of the androgen receptor does confer a different, not only molecular subtype, but a potentially different clinical, if you will, entity and response to chemotherapy. And using drugs and combination drug therapy for these patients, I think, is going to eventually make it to the clinic. Obviously, it's not there. So I think that in this setting right now, we're using this information as we can to try to help in best way put patients on the right drug in terms of clinical trials.
In terms of this, I think you called it luminal androgen receptor subtype. First of all, is that typically picked up in an NGS assay? Are there other ways, you know, IHC assays to study this? And is it just seen in triple negative or all across breast cancer?
Yeah, so I think where this is gaining the most traction, obviously, is in triple negative breast cancer. And right now, one could pick up the luminal androgen receptor if you were to do a, if you will, gene expression profiling. I think the standard NGS assays that are reported obviously would not provide information, or sequencing data would not give you information on whether the patient was luminal androgen receptor or not, unless that additional test was provided. So what a lot of us do in obviously our practice is test for the androgen receptor in patients with triple negative, knowing that that may be a target that we can approach and actually potentially put patients on clinical trials. This particular patient was tested for the androgen receptor, and interestingly, she was negative for that.
If she were to develop disease progression, and let's just say you picked it up by imaging and she was totally fine, and she wanted to participate in clinical research, what exactly would you suggest that she do?
Yeah, I think that I would really attempt to identify some sort of immune-based therapy, either a combination immunotherapy such as a checkpoint inhibitor, either alone or in combination with another agent. At our institution, we have a SPORE project in which the investigators, Dr. Eva Galanis and Dr. Manetta Liu, are testing combination viral therapy, a measles virus, along with checkpoint inhibitor, based on some compelling preclinical data suggesting that this combination may be quite effective in breast cancer. So I think that idea, that is trying to improve upon immunotherapy, either with combinations with chemotherapy, obviously there are some data combining with MEK inhibitors, this type of thing would be an approach that I would take with this patient.
At your particular institution, are there any trials that are ongoing right now that, you know, a patient like she could maybe enter?
Yeah. So we do have a number of clinical trials. I mentioned the luminal androgen receptor. We have a trial combining enzalutamide along with a PI3 kinase inhibitor. We do have the measles virus study. The first study that we have open is just the measles virus alone, and we have a follow-up study that is actually planned combining with a checkpoint inhibitor. So these would be two studies that I would think about right off the bat as possibilities for a patient with triple-negative breast cancer.
The measles study. I haven't heard about that lately. So that's kind of a, I think, Mayo Clinic particular interest. I'm kind of remembering that that was tied into myeloma, or am I not remembering that right?
That's right. It's actually the measles virus has been studied in a number of disease entities. And this particular study is actually based on preclinical research demonstrating the activity of the measles virus in a number of different breast cancer models. But then there's also data supporting that the measles virus treatment, in fact, in ovarian cancer, can activate the immune system. And that in preclinical models, combination with checkpoint inhibitors was quite synergistic. So that was really the basis of this combination and this approach going forward.
So let's talk about your next patient, the 49-year-old lady.
Okay. So this is actually a patient that was referred to us. She originally was diagnosed with a high-grade DCIS Interestingly, at the time of resection, there was some areas of microinvasion. The patient ultimately underwent a mastectomy because of close margins. And interestingly, the pathology at the time of surgery did show evidence that the microinvasive disease was ER negative and HER2 positive. She was treated locally with tamoxifen, interestingly, as a, quote, adjuvant therapy for prevention of recurrence in her contralateral breast cancer. And within about 2 to 3 years, she ultimately presented with a large right-sided chest mass, and workup at that time demonstrated evidence for multiple enlarged lymph nodes on the right side, this large mass, but interestingly, no visceral involvement. And biopsy at that time demonstrated ER negative, HER2 positive breast cancer.
Could I just ask if you had seen her at that point after she had the high-grade DCIS removed, would you have given her tamoxifen?
I think the data obviously now really support the fact that Craig Allred's secondary analysis of the NSABP B24 study suggests that there really is no benefit for the use of tamoxifen in ER-negative DCIS. Now, in this situation, she had some areas of microinvasion, but that microinvasion actually was also ER-negative. So the answer, Neil, would I would not support the use of tamoxifen in this situation.
So what was the next step with this lady?
Well, after she was worked up, as I mentioned, she did have evidence for this mediastinal mass, also a number of areas of lymph node involvement, as well as bone metastases. And so at that time, we did treat her with a combination of pertuzumab, trastuzumab, as well as docetaxel. And she had received a total of 4 cycles of the combination with chemotherapy. And after 4 cycles, we transitioned her to just maintenance pertuzumab and trastuzumab. She had a very nice response. In fact, she had a complete response to therapy and did well ultimately until about 2 years later when she again had evidence for recurrence, this time really in the same area in the right chest wall. And we again re-biopsied that just for confirmation that again was ER negative, HER2 positive.
So what was your thinking at that point? She's kind of in a pretty typical second-line situation now.
Yeah. So I think at that time, we obviously were aware of the emerging data with T-DM1 and the fact that this was a well-tolerated drug that could provide durable responses and potentially, obviously, as you know, better tolerated than lapatinib and capecitabine. And so that's what we did. We treated her with T-DM1. And really, she's been maintained on T-DM1 since February of 2014. And at this time, we just saw her just a few weeks ago, and she continues to do very well with no evidence of disease recurrence.
Any tolerability issues with the T-DM1? Any hair loss? Any nausea? Any thrombocytopenia? LFTs?
Yeah, so she did not have any evidence for nausea or thrombocytopenia. We've seen some slight increase in her liver enzymes, and she has actually required a dose reduction twice on the T-DM1 because of the liver enzyme issue. But in each situation, she's done well. Her liver enzymes have improved after the dose reduction.
Any thoughts about where things might head if she were to develop another progression on the T-DM1?
Sure. Well, I think this is where things are relatively wide open in the field of HER2-positive breast cancer, because once T-DM1 has sort of firmly come in as second-line therapy after the pertuzumab-based regimen, we don't really have, if you will, a clear winner or a choice that I think that we all think about. So this is an area where I typically will focus or try to identify clinical trials for patients who have progression. Obviously, if a patient had ER-positive, HER2-positive breast cancer, one could think about continuing or going back to anti-HER2-based therapy in combination with hormonal agents. But I think in this particular patient, we would be using drugs with probably not a whole lot of data. For example, the question of lapatinib and trastuzumab in this situation would be something that I would normally think about in the past, but again, with not a lot of data in this situation.
What have you observed in terms of tolerability issues with T-DM1? Any issues at all?
Yeah, so I have found this drug to be extremely well tolerated. And really the only thing that I've seen in my practice is this issue of some slight elevation in the liver enzymes. I have not seen much in the way of any other problematic or bothersome side effects for patients.
So let's go on and talk about your 65-year-old lady.
Sure. So this is a patient just recently saw in the clinic. She had originally been diagnosed with a 1.2 centimeter grade 2 invasive ductal carcinoma. This tumor was estrogen and progesterone receptor strongly positive, and she had a recurrence score when she was originally diagnosed of 15. And so we elected and recommended treatment with hormonal therapy alone. At the time that we saw her, we had recommended anastrozole as first-line therapy, and she had actually preferred to use tamoxifen. So we treated her with tamoxifen, and she completed a total of 5 years of tamoxifen.
How did she do on the tamoxifen?
No, she did extremely well. She really had no significant toxicities other than some mild hot flashes.
So then she comes up to the 5 year point. How long ago was that?
Yeah, that actually was just about 4 months ago. And at that time, we discussed the options, and that would be obviously to go off all endocrine therapy versus continuing on. In this case, we highly recommended that if we did continue on with therapy, that we would switch to an aromatase inhibitor. And at that time, she was interested in learning more about the potential risks for late recurrence. And she was quite undecided. She certainly was aware of this issue of the possibility of a late recurrence, but she was not convinced necessarily that she wanted to move on to a different drug or continue on with endocrine therapy.
I don't know if she asked you this, but if she had or if she did, and she said, what's the chance that at some point in time, moving forward after this 5 years, I will have a recurrence, assuming I do nothing? What would be your best guess as to what it would be? And would that estimate have been influenced by the previous recurrence score she had, which was low?
Yeah, so I think the data with regard to the recurrence score, at least that have been published thus far, would suggest that that provides you with the best estimates for early recurrence risk. And the recent data that I have been most, if you will, impressed with and I have used quite commonly in my practice, and that's the recent Oxford overview that was just presented at ASCO, where in a cohort of nearly 50,000 women who had received 5 years of endocrine therapy, the authors identified factors that were associated with late distant recurrence in years 5 through 14. And so in that particular study, for women who were node negative, the risk of developing a late distant recurrence in years 5 through 14 was about 9% or 9 to 10%. And so for this particular patient, that estimate of risk, obviously, for her, when we talked to her and said, for a patient in this situation, the risk could be the same, it could be a bit lower. Obviously, it could also be a bit higher based on some of the multi-gene studies that suggest that one can identify higher risk for late recurrence.
So were you interested or was she interested in trying to refine that 9% down so she get maybe even a better idea?
Yeah, so she certainly was. And so at that point, we did offer her testing with the breast cancer index, and we did receive the results of that back. Her testing demonstrated a score of 6.6, which interestingly corresponded to a distant risk of about 8%. So in this particular situation, the score that was received really didn't change much, if you will, the risk that I had quoted her initially. However, I think in this situation, knowing that the BCI test can identify a subset of patients with a higher risk or a much lower risk, I still think that the patient felt that this information was helpful.
And what did she decide and you decide to do?
So based on this information and speaking with her, she actually felt that this risk was low enough that she did not want to proceed on with additional therapy. And so at this point, we're observing her.
You know, you mentioned that she did so well on the tamoxifen, you wanted to switch her to an AI. But if you had come back to her and said, you know, it's 8% risk, would you want to keep the tamoxifen going? Do you think she would have been more inclined to do it?
Yeah, I would say in this situation that I'm a bit colored by the data from the ADAM and ATLAS studies, which really suggests that the longer duration that you're on tamoxifen, although there's clearly benefit in terms of breast cancer-specific survival, that one begins to see an increased risk as it relates to the uterine side effects. And so when I talked to her about that, she was more inclined to either do nothing or to move on to letrozole. And based on the numbers I shared with her from the BCI test, she elected to proceed with no additional therapy.
What is your experience with the breast cancer index? Have you used it in other patients in the same situation? And what would be sort of a high or low? You said this one was kind of more in the middle, but what have you seen?
Yeah, so the numbers that have been obviously published and that I have seen range from a distant recurrence risk anywhere from 3-4% up to about 15%. And so, as you know, when we see patients and we use the recurrence score, one of the things that's very helpful is the very wide range of risk from the Taylor RX showing a distant recurrence risk of less than 1% to the data from the NSABP studies, the original NSABP studies from Soon-Paik showing a distant risk up to 30-35 or even 40%. So in this particular situation, the range, if you will, the delta is actually a little bit smaller. But when we're talking about extending therapy beyond and up to 10 years, my experience that patients still find this helpful.
Just to finish out on the BCI, the breast cancer index, you know, a lot of these genomic assays almost kind of, I don't know, it's almost like a religious, you know, do you believe in it? For people like myself, the statistics sometimes are a little bit intimidating. But when you look at the data, maybe you can talk about the data that you've seen. I mean, it's one thing to say, okay, here's a risk of 3% or 15%. But how were the data derived and how valid do you think these estimates are? And what do we know about benefit? I mean, yeah, maybe there's a risk of 8%, but is that going to change with hormonal therapy?
Yeah. So this is obviously a really great point. And I think one of the things that I like to first start out with is when I'm seeing a patient is we would like a more accurate estimate of what that risk is in years 5 through 14. And so I think a number of these tests may be helpful giving a more accurate estimate, especially for the node negative patients, which, as you know, most of those patients are doing quite well. Where I think it's much more difficult, Neil, is this issue of benefit or predictive. Is the test predictive of benefit? And I think that's where right now I'm still a bit skeptical. And that is obviously because we have very few data sets out there that is of extended adjuvant therapy versus no therapy where we can confidently say that these tests are predictive of benefit. So I think where clinicians can find these tests potentially helpful is simply from a prognostic standpoint. Is the risk so low that continuing on with therapy really that if the relative benefit is the same, but the absolute benefit is so small, then one can fairly confidently tell our patients that based on such a low risk that they could feel confident in foregoing additional therapy.
And you mentioned that in terms of the 21-gene recurrence score, that was your perception. This is mainly helpful in terms of early recurrence. To what extent has it been looked at in terms of predicting late? Has it actually been looked at?
Yeah, so obviously there are data from the NSABP that have looked at the recurrence score and have specifically looked at the question of ESR1 and expression and its relationship to distant recurrence. And so many of the drivers, if you will, of early recurrence, such as proliferation and Ki-67, may not necessarily be the drivers of late recurrence. And so the NSABP group has looked at this and it looked at the question of the recurrence score. The data that they have published suggests that actually that's the ESR1, which appears to be a major driver or associated with late recurrences. ESR1 obviously is just estrogen receptor mRNA expression. And we obviously do know that the estrogen receptor is a critical component of the recurrence score, but obviously it's the target for our therapies. And so as one might expect in this situation, a tumor that has low levels of expression of estrogen receptor, high proliferation genes, those tumors are likely to be more driven by factors other than the estrogen receptor, and studies would suggest that these patients are at higher risk for early recurrence. But patients who have high levels of the estrogen receptor and who have already benefited from hormonal therapy, that these groups of patients may benefit then obviously from extended adjuvant therapy. So a tumor that has low levels of ESR1 would be expected obviously then in that situation to potentially have less benefit from extended adjuvant therapy simply because those tumors either recurred early on and they're not present, and also the need to continually inhibit the expression or inhibit the target, the estrogen receptor.
We sent several papers to get your comment on, a couple of which were presented at ASCO related to the breast cancer index. And I want to start out with this one study that was looking at patients with positive nodes, 1-3 positive nodes. What were your thoughts about what they looked at there and what do you think it means?
Well, I think if you look at some of the original studies that have looked at the BCI, if you kind of go back all the way to the beginning of the development of that test, as you recall, the authors originally identified HOXB13 and IL-17BR, that ratio as predicting recurrence. And when they published those data, we actually did a validation study with HOXB13 and IL-17BR in a paper published in Clinical Cancer Research a few years ago. And what we found in that particular study, Neil, was actually, this was a secondary analysis of a prospective adjuvant tamoxifen study. What we found was that actually there was no prognostic association of the HOXB13 IL-17 with node positive patients. In fact, we only saw this in node negative patients. And since then, there have been a number of other studies that have additionally found the same thing. And so a few years later, the developers of this test added on the 5-gene panel, or if you will, a molecular 5-gene marker of proliferation, and they put that together with HOXB13 IL-17 into a 11-gene panel that's called the BCI. And in the studies that have been done more recently, this marker has continued to be looked at in node negative. And so as these developers of this test have wondered, could this be a marker again in node positive? So this particular abstract that was presented that you just mentioned, the authors have derived a different, if you will, cut point for the use of the 11-gene assay and have identified this using these different cut points that this may be prognostic for node positive breast cancer.
And any thoughts about the general concept of making the decision at 5 years? Maybe it'd be worth talking about the data that were presented at ASCO looking at endocrine therapy and what your thoughts are about that.
So the MA17R obviously was a study where patients who were originally on the MA17 clinical trial, that is patients who had completed 5 years of tamoxifen and ultimately 5 years of letrozole, were re-randomized to another 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor, that is letrozole versus a placebo. And in this trial, the authors also elected to allow any patient that had received 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor in order to increase the numbers, the statistical power. And as you know, Paul Goss presented data showing that the use of letrozole did improve disease-free survival, but not overall survival. And this observation in most patients led to a relatively small improvement in disease-free survival. And so one of the questions that comes up in terms of the applicability of this to our patients is this so-called small improvement in disease-free survival with now using therapy out to 10 years, and in some cases out to 15 years, should this be applied to our patients? And I think that where this data has now, in my mind, been most useful to apply is based on the Oxford overview, where we begin to see patients, especially very, very high-risk patients, node positive, some patients up to 4 to 9 positive lymph nodes, who had a distant recurrence risk that approached 30%. And so I think for the average patient that we see in our clinic, the use of extended adjuvant therapy, the absolute benefits are going to be small. But there's clearly a small group of patients, a group of very high-risk patients, that I think we can now say clearly do benefit. And by identifying those patients, we can extend therapy now clearly out to 10 years and improve disease-free survival. And then hopefully, obviously by doing this, the quality of life of patients who would otherwise be impacted by breast cancer recurrence.
How influenced are you by the original nodal status in the decision to continue or not at 5 years?
In my practice, that's the thing that I speak most to my patients about, because obviously, if you look at the Oxford overview that was presented, nodal status was the major driver of distant recurrence. And so right now, when I'm speaking to patients, that's obviously the main factor that I think of when I'm thinking about extended adjuvant therapy. And obviously for those patients who have no negative disease where the distant recurrence risk is less than 10%, this is where we clearly need better ways to, if you will, risk stratify these patients. And these are where some of these multi-gene assays may be helpful.
So in terms of the issue of genomic assays, of course, the main area where people are utilizing these, specifically in ER-positive, HER2-negative, is upfront decisions, particularly about adjuvant chemotherapy. And I noticed that this lady had a 21-gene recurrence score. Initially, she was, I believe, 1.2 centimeter node negative. Can you talk first about, in general, how you approach decision-making and whether or not to use either that assay or any other one in the upfront situation?
Yeah. So right now, our practice really for patients where I see in the clinic where decisions are being made with regard to chemotherapy, we're using a recurrence score predominantly. And so my approach in these patients, obviously the first thing that I ask and when I see patients is before I order a recurrence score is to discuss with patients their potential ability to tolerate or interest in chemotherapy. I see a fair number of patients in their 60s and 70s who tell me, regardless of, you know, the recurrence score, they really are not interested in or may not be candidates for chemotherapy. So this is obviously an important part of the decision making. There are other patients who I meet who are not interested in chemotherapy, but are very interested in the prognosis, that is the prognostic information that comes from the recurrence score. And so for these patients, I will offer them the recurrence score as well.
What about in patients with node-positive disease?
Yeah, so in patients with node-positive disease, I'm fairly convinced, Neil, of the fact that the recurrence score has been shown in multiple different studies to be prognostic. Obviously, the data from SWOG-8814 in terms of the predictive ability would suggest that patients that are at highest risk or in the high-risk category do derive benefit from chemotherapy, but patients in the low-risk category, not only do they have a lower risk, but clearly in that study did not seem to derive benefit from adjuvant chemotherapy. So my approach is for patients that have 1 to 3 positive lymph nodes who have a cancer that otherwise would seemingly be endocrine responsive to offer the recurrence score in that situation.
Could you talk a little bit about the just published so-called MINDAC study looking at the 70 gene signature, what they looked at there, and what you think it means?
Yeah, so the MINDAC obviously was an important study that looked at this issue of so-called clinical high risk and genomic low risk versus the opposite, that is genomic high risk and clinical low risk. And obviously, in this particular study, one of the things that they wanted to identify is whether those patients that are genomically low risk but clinically high risk could avoid chemotherapy. And so, as you know, this particular study offered patients who were clinically low risk and genomic low risk endocrine therapy, and those patients that were clinically and genomic high risk received chemotherapy. And it was those patients where there was a difference between those two, or if you will, a discrepancy between those, that is clinically high risk and genomic low risk, or vice versa, who were randomized to receive chemotherapy or not. And the primary endpoint of the study was just be able to identify those patients that were genomically low risk but yet clinically high risk, that they actually had a distant disease-free survival that was acceptable. And the primary endpoint of the study was met. Now, I think that interestingly about this particular study, and that is obviously the recurrence score is something that we've gotten and we've become quite accustomed to use here in the U.S. And I think the question, as I talk to my colleagues about these data, is will these data really change our practice such that we'll begin to use the 70 gene assay over and above the recurrence score? And most people that I've spoken to have suggested that probably at this point that these data are important. They are clearly level A or level 1 data, that they're probably not enough in their minds to change what they've been using already, which is the recurrence score. But clearly, there are enough data that I would say that if a clinician wanted to use the 70 gene assay, that this would clearly be acceptable, it would be supported by the data that was published.
So in terms of the way you saw those data, I guess one of the questions is, are they able to identify patients with, quote, high-risk disease clinically, which really to a great extent means node positive, whose prognosis is so good that really you couldn't improve it that much with chemotherapy, I guess maybe in the range of 5% recurrence or not. Do you think that they demonstrated that?
Yeah, I think that, as you know, in that particular study, there was still a small benefit of chemotherapy, even in these sort of clinically high risk, genomically low risk, but the delta or the absolute benefit was actually quite small. And I think that these data will need to be placed, obviously, into the context of the upcoming or the data that have not been published, but we hopefully will have soon from the RxPonder study. The interesting thing about the MINDAC trial was they included both the node positive and node negative patients. And so we can clearly now say that there are level 1 data for this group of patients.
So let's talk about your last patient, a 57-year-old woman.
So this is a patient of mine who presented actually at the age of 57 with de novo breast cancer. She presented with a palpable mass within her left breast. And at the time of workup, she had metastases to her lymph nodes, and a staging workup demonstrated metastases involving the liver and bone.
Was there any issue about delay? Did she come in promptly or was there a delay?
Yeah, that's a great question. There was no delay. This is a patient that had been receiving yearly mammograms, and so this would be an interval cancer that had developed.
And so what did the rest of the workup show?
So she, at the time, was, as I mentioned, was diagnosed with metastases. She had metastases to the lymph nodes, supraclavicular, infraclavicular region. And she also had one lesion in her liver and numerous lesions in her bone as well. And a biopsy demonstrated grade 3 ER negative, PR negative, and HER2 negative breast cancer. And at the time, she was actually interested in clinical trials, and she was enrolled onto a phase 3 trial that's run through Accrue, in which patients are being randomized in the first-line metastatic setting to either weekly paclitaxel or eribulin. And she was randomized to the eribulin arm, and she tolerated the therapy beautifully. She did have an initial response, but unfortunately progressed after 6 months on the eribulin. So at that time, we actually discussed treating her with pembrolizumab, and we actually had a clinical trial that was open at the time, and unfortunately, the eligibility for that trial did require that patients to have received both prior anthracycline and taxane-based chemotherapy. And so she obviously had not received the anthracycline being diagnosed in the metastatic setting, and so she went on to receive Doxil chemotherapy.
So what happened and what's the current situation?
Yeah. So like previously, she did have, was on therapy for about 3 to 4 months, and she did have evidence for a mixed response with some response within the breast, but progression in her nodal regions. She then went on to receive capecitabine as a single agent and had what I would call a mixed response to therapy. And from that, she went on to receive a platinum-based regimen. In this case, we treated her with paclitaxel and carboplatin. And we elected to treat her with a combination therapy, interestingly, because that would then allow her to be eligible potentially for other checkpoint inhibitor studies down the road. And during this workup, we did test her tumor for the androgen receptor, and she was found to have, by IHC, greater than 75% nuclear staining with strong staining. And so at that point, after having, again, fairly rapid progression on the regimen of carboplatin and paclitaxel, she has been recently placed on a clinical trial of enzalutamide along with a PI3 kinase inhibitor that's being conducted through the Translational Breast Cancer Research Consortium.
And how's she doing on the treatment?
You know, she literally started her first treatment last Friday.
So this lady was considered for a trial of a checkpoint inhibitor. I'm curious where we are today with that strategy. Maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, your impression of the minimal data, I guess, that we have, and whether you think there's a future role for these agents in breast cancer.
So obviously the data still are early, but the initial phase 1 data that was presented by Rita Nanda et al. In JCO really suggests that these drugs do have activity. And as you know, in that phase 1 clinical trial, patients with triple negative breast cancer, there were a relatively low response rate in that single digit to teens rate, but some of the patients had substantial and durable responses observed. There are a number of other studies that have been presented but have not been published in this area, and there are a number of registration approaches that are ongoing in patients with triple negative breast cancer. And my impression thus far when I've seen these data, and it's sort of putting it all together with the data in some of the other tumor types where obviously we do have approval for the checkpoint inhibitors, I do suspect that this is going to be an approach that will be beneficial for patients with triple negative breast cancer. The other thing I think is what's really interesting thus far is that patients with ER positive breast cancer and some of the early reports have not seemed to benefit as much from the checkpoint inhibitors as those with triple negative breast cancer. So I think as we go forward, we're going to need clear data as to the efficacy of this regimen in patients with triple negative breast cancer, but also, is this an approach that really has value for patients with metastatic ER positive breast cancer?
What about today in terms of a patient who's in good condition, has already received, you know, approved therapies for metastatic triple negative breast cancer? Have you or would you attempt to access a checkpoint inhibitor outside a trial setting?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I've attempted actually only in one patient. And it was actually a patient of mine who was being worked up for a checkpoint inhibitor study. And she was eligible for the study, except for the fact that on her staging workup that was required for the study, she was found to have asymptomatic brain metastases. In fact, she had several right frontal brain mets. And these were treated with Gamma Knife, and the patient was otherwise asymptomatic. And so at that point, I worked with her local doc to try to gain access to the drug. And interestingly, unfortunately, as we were trying to gain access to the drug, the patient later on developed progression within the brain and ultimately passed away from disease that progressed within the brain.
One other thing I was going to ask you about, and I think you're doing a trial, the issue of sort of the window of opportunity neoadjuvant type trials. Breast Cancer Genome Guided Therapy Study, BEAUTY.
Yeah. So we actually have been very interested in identifying genomic markers that are associated with response to chemotherapy, but also understanding the role of next generation sequencing in patients who are receiving standard therapy. So the Breast Cancer Genome Guided Therapy Study was a prospective neoadjuvant study where patients who were recommended to receive standard neoadjuvant chemotherapy for locally advanced breast cancer were enrolled. And in this particular study, we did obtain biopsies anywhere from 4 to 6 cores up front from their primary tumor. And those cores were used for next generation sequencing, including exome sequencing, RNA sequencing. And we also, Neil, developed patient-derived xenografts on all these patients. We also then, at the time that they had completed their neoadjuvant chemotherapy, obtained tissue at the time of surgery, and we did the same thing. That is, again, we sequenced the tumor, and we also injected their tumor into mice to obtain patient-derived xenografts. And so the goal of this study was to identify genomic markers that could potentially be targetable. We know that in patients that have chemotherapy resistance in the neoadjuvant setting, they're at risk for distant recurrence. And so one of the things that we were interested in was, could we identify where some of these known targets that have been previously reported, are they enriched in patients who have chemotherapy resistance and could therefore be targeted and used in patients that are at high risk for development of distant recurrence?
So what have you found out so far, if anything?
Yeah, so we actually have recently submitted this for publication, and we're hoping to have these data published soon. But what we found in the study, Neil, was that we did not see enrichment of targets that could be used to pull, so if you will, take FDA-approved drugs that are approved for another tumor and sort of pull them off the shelf. And what I'm thinking about here and what our data showed, Neil, is that in patients that have disease resistance, that is, who have residual disease at the time of surgery, those patients did not seem to have an enrichment of druggable targets. We were obviously hopeful at the time that we developed the study that we would identify alterations in tyrosine kinases, perhaps HER2 mutations, PIK3CA mutations, other alterations that could be readily targetable and that could then, as a proof of principle, be tested using the PDXs, and that could then potentially lead us on to subsequent studies testing those drugs in these patients. But we did not see evidence for that.
Well, congratulations for actually executing the study. I mean, it really, it's fantastic that you did this. How many people did you do it in?
So we enrolled 140 patients, and one of the interesting things that we identified in this particular study was that we were able to develop patient-derived xenografts in about 50% of the triple-negative breast cancers, in about 25 to 30% of the HER2-positive breast cancers. And as other people have shown, we're not able to really, with any success, develop patient-derived xenografts in the ER-positive patients. In fact, we had just several PDXs that were developed in the luminal B subtype.
But still, 140 patients that you got through that protocol is incredible. What a great study.
This concludes our program, and if you'd like to have a case from your practice presented to one of our program faculty, please email me your case at drneillove@researchtopractice.com. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Breast Cancer Update.